So I'm Catherine Robertson-Hodder, and it's my pleasure to introduce Jeff Humphreys. Oh, I should get the little blurb on you, Jeff. So Jeff's been practicing as an actuary in the superannuation industry for over 20 years. Over this period, he's been heavily involved in the group risk market and providing design and pricing advice to trustees, employers and life officers, both as an employed actuary and since 1996 as a consulting actuary. He was a member of the SCT for 6 years until 2011. So it's our pleasure to have Jeff to talk to us today about... I'll let you talk to that. And so Jeff said he's happy to take questions along the way, so if I can just ask if you're going to do that, that you make your way to the microphone and introduce yourself and ask the question. Okay? Thanks for that.
Thanks, Catherine. This topic had a number of headings on the website, you'll see, but the one I've chosen today is this one. Death and Disability Benefit Design in a Dysfunctional Insurance Market. So we're going to talk about, and possibly I'll have a different view to what you've heard in the conference, so maybe a bit controversial, I don't know. A little bit on dysfunctional market, and then look at some misconceptions that I think are around in our market, and then just get into the nitty-gritty of the paper, which is really about design, needs-based designs, and how easy they are. Can you close the door, please? Thank you. Needs-based design, how that translates into a default design, and what's the right level of premium, because they're really critical things that trustees are trying to understand and cope with at the moment. So dysfunctional market. I've got a quote here from David Murray from the other day. He points out that the financial system has some unhealthy concentration areas. Areas in the superannuation system that aren't a very big group, and do they all act in the same way? Is there genuine competition? So when you look at that's our group life market as it is now. That's really insurers acting in the same way, reinsurers acting in the same way, and there is no competition. We have lots of funds that can only get the incumbent to quote. And so we have a dysfunctional market. And it's a really bad place for us to have ended up, for whatever reason. Now, we know the advantage of having the private sector involved in providing a service is really only because of the competitive forces that it brings. And those competitive forces bring efficiency and they bring innovation. So I think I'll be showing in a little bit why... We don't have competitive forces, and we also don't have efficiency in our market. That's a very bad, as I say, it's a very bad place to have ended up. Now, I think a lot of the lack of competition is driven by particularly reinsurer mispricing back in the 2009-10 period. And it's not necessarily mispricing. It's that you couldn't predict, based on the past, the experience that was going to unfold in the future, and nobody did. But the reinsurers offered... in a competitive environment, offered competitive commissions to their ceding officers. So I think you'll see the ceding officers haven't made losses to the extent that reinsurers have. We have the poor TPD experience and a lot of poor design features around TPD. And we have TPD as a primary benefit for disability in most funds, and that's a poor design feature in itself. And we have a lot of panic. There's a lot of panic, and I have a slide in here that shows in some ways we're in a big cycle, perhaps. But we also have a regulator that isn't helping. It's anti-competitive. It's anti-innovation. And it's failed its own mission statement, which is to provide an efficient market, and we don't have an efficient market. And probably more importantly, it's failed the people who are paying for its way, which are the consumers, or in our case the members, ultimately paying for APRA's existence. This is a graph of the history of ACE Superfund in Australia. I've gone back to 1992, but all these rates are publicly available, so you can dig them out if you've been in the industry long enough. And you can see that over time, if I just go down here, so Becky, we've got each of the age groups, 25, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, And this is the history of those rates since 1992, 1995, and they change the rate, change the rate, change the rate, change the rate, change the rate. And you can see a bit of a pattern of a cycle. So current rates are 100%. Where were they back? As a proportion of the current 100%. That makes sense. So what I think we've seen is an improvement in experience, improvement in rates, and then a deterioration experience that wasn't predictable, and we're now picking that up. Now there's some evidence that this rate here is now overpriced. I don't know, you're saying maybe it isn't yet finished, but there is some evidence that for this fund anyway, we've gone over the top with the pricing. So I think there are cycles in group insurance, and they're not like the general insurance cycle, which is very short. You have a catastrophe, premiums go up, lots of profits, premiums come down, and that seems to happen every about 3 years or 4 years. This one's a longer term cycle. Now the other thing that happens is we have had a jump in the claim rate. There's no doubt we've had a jump in the claim rate with awareness, and I think everyone just accepts that. We're still going to get cycles around the new equilibrium. And the industry is finding its equilibrium. There's lots of discussion about premium increases, and this graph just puts it into some sort of perspective, because everyone seems to concentrate on these ones, and a few funds have had massive increases, there's no doubt about that. But most funds have had no reduction or very little reduction, and this is since 1 July 12. And there's a few still coming. But in general, the industry is adjusting to the poor experience quite well. So I've got eight funds with a reduction or no increase, and another six with an increase of only up to 25%, which, you know, in the context of all the reductions that have occurred in the history is actually quite small. So I think that gives some perspective, because a lot of the time I talk to people, they're concentrating on always on the fear side or the panic side. All this stuff. Okay. Another perspective on group insurance is to actually look at it other than on a 1 year basis. So if we go back to the start of the APRA available stats 5.5 years ago, group super premiums $16 billion. And the insurers have walked away with $5 billion of that. But whether that's profit or expense margin, that's about $1 billion a year. There's a 20% expense margin, and it's increasing. This is according to APRA stats. 5% profit margin, and it's falling. Now, until 2013, there's a rough rule of thumb, a 5% profit margin represented a 15% return on capital. In our industry. It doesn't since then, because the capital requirements have increased. So on a 5 year basis, the industry is doing very well, and it's now adjusting. So I don't think all the panic and the I think there's an overreaction to very recent experience. I think a lot of the very recent experience is correcting for past years, and the APRA stats don't actually break the premium cohorts into the claims cohorts that belong to those premiums. So you've got this year's premiums compared to this year's experience plus all the adjustment for the last X years of under-reserving. So this is the cumulative basis. And what we find is, as I said, the green line's the expense line. It's quite amazing to me that an expense line can be going up given the massive increases in premiums we've had. So the industry is becoming less efficient as it gets bigger. And that to me, highlights one of the problems we've got with the lack of competition. That we're, if you like, we're getting fat off the back of the laziness of a lot of lack of competition. On the other hand, the profit levels have fallen dramatically, and that, of course, is bad news. But as I say, it has been corrected. It's actually been corrected very, very rapidly with some of those increases. And I pulled out four of the increases. Five, seven. four of the largest funds, their increase alone would represent 10 to 15% of the premium. So the industry can self-correct very, very, very quickly, and it has done. And there's no need for the massive panic that's gone on, in my opinion. Instead of that, what we're going to have, I think, is some insurer damage through reputation, because there will be some profit gouging, and there will be super profits. I think there's evidence of overstating past losses, and I can understand that if I was the actuary guaranteeing my bosses that this is the maximum loss I can make, I would probably go very conservative. But I think there's also the danger as an industry that we price the whole thing out of the range of the trustee, and they say it's inappropriate that my members are actually paying for these benefits at these extraordinary profitable rates, or with this extraordinary inefficient 20% margin that's going off to the insurers. And of course they have a CIS obligation to make sure that the benefit is appropriate and not eroding the retirement savings accounts of members. Nevertheless, we run a few tenders, or get involved in a few tenders, and last year, yeah, it's fair to say, some insurers are sometimes providing a fair premium, amazingly, in this market, I'd have to say. It's very, very reassuring. Fair premium and fair guarantees, so not short-term guarantees. And they're considering the risks put in front of them. They're not falling back on generalities, APRA, trends, whatever else they want to blame for finding an excessive price. And they also happen to be the insurers who can find a way around the reinsurer roadblock. And there's a massive capital strike on the reinsurer side. These are the insurers that are going to retain their long-term relationships. And that should be more important to a business, I would have thought, than short-term profit, super profits. Okay, that's enough of dysfunctional markets. Misconceptions. Now, I love this sentence out of the APRA Insight Issue 3, 2013, because to me it highlights a lot of misconceptions and perhaps why we're talking about needs-based designs today. And the sort of thing that suggested to me, it might be useful to actually talk about needs-based designs and how really easy they are to implement if you want to do it. So APRA notes that much growth in group insurance business in the past has been generated from changing benefit designs and structures to better meet superannuation members' needs. This strategy may be nearing exhaustion, as now seems that trustees are redirecting their attention to the impact of the cost of insurance premiums are having on members at retirement benefits. So, is that misconceived? It's not really a dig at APRA at all. It's the view of a lot of people would be this. Now, this strategy, meeting members' needs is not a strategy, it's a requirement of the law. But APRA has effectively dismissed needs-based designs and designs that meet members' needs as a strategy. It can't be a strategy. It's what a good trustee does. And it can't be exhausted. It has to be addressed until it's completed. And it doesn't necessarily cost more than other designs. It costs different. The other misconception there is that retirement is viewed as a very narrow sort of concept here. Members' retirement benefits are being hit by a cost. In fact, what the member is doing is a risk mitigation strategy. The risk of retiring early, involuntarily, because you're disabled or because you die. It's not really a cost as such. It's risk mitigation, or spreading your account balance across your various risks. Risk of retiring because it's voluntary and your age, or risk of retiring because you're disabled. So I think that highlighted a couple of things to me anyway, where I think there are misconceptions. It kicks off the idea of what's a needs-based design. I've gone through all that. You can read about that on the web. So the not uncommon attitude of dismissing needs-based designs is it's too hard, cost members too much, not worthwhile, not at this time. Classic, not at this time. But is it? So let's have a look at a needs-based design. I'll go through a bit of detail of how we do it with our industry fund clients to the extent they want to listen to us. So trustees trying to marry value for money, affordability. So value for money, are the rates fair to the insurer? And for most trustees nowadays, is it fair to the member and the insurer? Not just is it fair to us? Have we screwed the insurer enough? Have we banged the table enough? Not many trustees do that anymore. Not the ones I deal with anyway. Is it affordable? So is it a reasonable balance between the saving for unexpected and expected retirement? That's how I view it. Equity, do the rates broadly reflect the underlying risk? So a lot of people call that cross-subsidy, but I think cross-subsidy is a very emotional word, so I like to say talk about expected risk. So does it reflect expected risk? And they're trying to balance the design, in this case needs-based design, and I'll talk about why it optimises the economic value for the member. And they're also trying to make something simple and logical. So it's got to be logical to me. The design has to be logical. It has to have a purpose. It's not just, as perhaps we did in the 2000s, the rates can be cut, therefore let's increase the benefits. And up they go proportionately, or even disproportionately. So that's not logical. Okay. Trustee responsibility. There's always limitations on the products available, so you've got to work around the product limitation. So we basically going to talk about these two bold ones, affordable and needs-based design. Firstly, the needs-based design, and then the affordable bit, because there's a few benchmarks I think are really interesting to look at in terms of affordable. People get really stroppy about how much people are spending on premiums, but I think, in fact, there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room in the premium, particularly at the ages where people need more cover. There's a lot of room to increase premiums. The first thing you need in a design, of course, is a philosophy, because it gives clarity, consistency of purpose, and the message to the member, the message to all the providers. Provide some answers to some difficult questions. So some of the philosophical questions I think that trustees should be answering, I've just got a list there. Should you do more than just make a payout for a disabled member? I mean, that's all TPD does. It says, here's some money, off you go, and forgets about you. Is that enough? And the same with a spouse, if their partner dies. Should you just give them a lump sum and say, here you go? Or should we do more for them? Has a disabled member who cannot ever work again retired from the workforce? Sort of gone there. The collectivism versus individualism is very important. How much is the trustee going to share the experience, and how much is it going to try and charge on a expected claims cost basis? I've got 4 points here on why a needs-based design is optimal. So it's going to be the most sustainable, is based on replacing the economic loss of the person. So they've actually got a real loss, if you like. It's indemnity cover, not fixed cover. And it focuses the premium. So we're taking a premium and we're going to give it to people who actually need the benefit. We know 80%, 90%, maybe only 70% or 60% now of the premium will go back as claims. So those claims need to be for people who have a genuine economic loss. So we shouldn't be over-insuring the young. That's the classic. We over-insure the young for death. They do not have a need for death cover. Needs-based design meets legislative requirements. Now, I'll just knock that one up. That's the CIS Covenant, Section 527A111. So the basis of the decision to offer or acquire insurance of those kinds with cover at that level, having regard to the demographic composition of the beneficiaries. So a trustee who hasn't done that is in breach of their CIS Covenant. The demographic composition is generally considered to be the age, the sex, family status and the income. So if the cover at that level or levels does not take into account those factors, then really you're in breach of CIS now. I don't know. I think a needs-based design certainly covers off on that. There may be other ways of doing it. Okay. So if we get into the needs-based design, key elements of the design, we're trying to replace the economic loss. We're also trying to minimise the economic loss. So that's the rehab, return to work strategy stuff. And we want to cover transition expenses for the disabled person. And I think that's where the TPD benefit has some value in transition expenses. But other than that, they don't really have a place in a good design. And what we find in a needs-based design is disability is not death. The TPD benefit does not equal the death benefit. They're totally different needs to be met. We're after indemnity, not agreed value. And this sort of design applies at the individual level as well as at the default level. You can apply this whole design concept at both levels, seems to me. So when we do these, there's different bases on which you can establish how you're going to provide the cover. But we tend to set something like this. Cover at a level that will enable the member and the member's dependents to broadly maintain their lifestyle following death or disablement of the member. You could say it's the current lifestyle, or I suppose if you want to be really generous, you could kick that out to the expected future lifestyle. But you won't get insurance cover for that, so you might as well go back to current lifestyle. And current lifestyle is pretty well determined by salary for most people, particularly working people. So economic loss, to me, is your salary plus your super cons, whether 10% or 12%. Now, we could make it expenditure and not worry about savings, but most people actually spend all their salary when you look at the ABS numbers, so there's no point adjusting. For the majority of Australians, they're spending their salary, particularly if you exclude the purchase of the family home. Now, the needs-based design, where we have to do a lump sum, it's just a present value calculation, and we have to do a lump sum on death at the moment. Well, I'm sure some creative types will come up with an income stream benefit on death, but at the moment we don't have that. So we're projecting salary to maximum the retirement age, taking into account the probability of payment and discounting it. This is just a point to point out. Economic loss is not just the mortgage, paying off the mortgage, and it's not just paying off some private school fees. It's a whole stack more than that. It's all about your whole salary, which only... Most of your salary goes to things other than the mortgage and private school fees. Salary is an income stream, so the benefit should primarily be an income stream. It's very simple. We have long-term IP. That's not always available, but generally it's available. So long-term IP benefit should be your basic disability benefit in a needs-based design. We should allow for super contributions to continue. And that's very easy to do, and most insurers will quite happily allow 10% or even 15% to go into the funds account for the member. We should be making allowance for increasing living standards, so indexing to CPI is not as good as a WADI. That depends on, I guess, what you're willing to pay for it and what's available in the market. So we've got an income stream. Death benefits, we allow for remarriage rates, and then they're the remarriage rates of widows and widowers, which are actually a lot slower than divorcees because they have to have a period of mourning. So the economic loss ceases on remarriage is the assumption. You don't have to do that, but you get some extremely big numbers and probably over-insurance if you don't assume that people remarry. They remarry at quite high rates at younger ages, particularly females, and then it drops off. So it's a male-female. It does actually vary quite a bit by age and gender, but it's worth including remarriage rates. So you might say the average benefit period then is only 6 years of salary, rather than all the way through to age 65, for example, particularly for a young person, because within 6 years they're probably remarried. For an individual, we can take into account unused retirement savings as well, 50% of the account. I mean, some of this is a bit of detail. You can take it or leave it if you're doing this sort of design. we allow for dependent children and their age of ceasing dependency. There's some assumptions on that. When do they ever cease being dependent? For IP, we set a waiting period based on for what funds generally have some idea of what the unused sick leave is of their members. So you can actually integrate the IP waiting period back into unused sick leave. We'll get some data out of some of the employers. And for disability, TPD covers the transition costs and there'll be a shortfall on the IP. So to the extent the market will provide you with some TPD cover, you can get a transition cost. We would typically allow, say, $60,000 for transition costs. There's not a lot of science in that. You can put a lot more effort into working out what is a transition cost. So we're looking at rehab, we're looking at retraining costs, and we're looking at house modification. So our whole focus here, I should have said, was for the disabled person, they're permanently disabled. So temporary disablement just has to piggyback off this. And then, yeah, we've got designs in the IP benefits for those. So TPD does have a place, but it's only a minor place. It's a minor part of the benefit design. If it's individual, you include assets and debts, and that's what the financial planning industry does. We would argue against including the family home. So leave. If someone's dying, you don't want to take them out of their family home as well as get them to lose their spouse at the same time. And we'd exclude super, because super is, for most of us anyway, for retirement savings. Now, most trustees have very good age data. They've got date of birth down pat. They've got pretty good gender data. Despite the fact someone the other day decided they don't have a gender. So that should add a bit of colour to us, and the court agreed with them. And they really have good salary data nowadays too. Because if you take the SG comp and divide by 0.09, you're pretty well there. You have to exclude the outliers. Because quite often you'll find $25,000 divided by 0.09. It's a very big number, but it's not really their SG comp. So there is a little bit of data manipulation, but you can get a good picture of what the salary structure looks like by age. And of course, there's lots of ABS data about family structures and how you might bring those in. Disability Care Australia provides a totally different benefit, as we heard in the last session. It's not really it's not an income provided, it's a series of services to help you get through the care. We don't allow for Centrelink benefits because they're unpredictable and they're not really readily available, and we apply the government minimum criteria in the CIS Act. Here's a salary scale we dug out for a fund. No names. And we do it by median lower quartile and upper quartile by age. So this one actually increases very rapidly. Right? So by about 28, 29, they're on about $60,000. And really, they hardly ever change. It's quite straightforward. That's the median. And there's a higher pay. There's no adjustment here to annualise anything. It's actually what they've been paid over the year. All these members. A trustee can, we'd sit down with a trustee and say, well, which one of these, you can only choose one in the end if you're doing defaults. Which one of these would you like to base your benefit on? You're going to have a default, you're going to have an AAL set up here. Right. And so we're just taking the present value for these people of the lost salary. And we do a bit of smoothing there, it doesn't bump around all over the place. There's a bit of smoothing done, so. And underneath, I've just repeated that graph here, and then underneath is a different group of people with a different salary structure, obviously a smaller fund. And again, you get a very good picture of what the salary looks like by age. So we actually can readily create benefits that are based on the salary structure of median members or whatever we want to choose within the fund. How am I going for time? Obviously, you've got to choose a retirement age. You've got to choose a family status because we're going to move people. When you're doing the death benefit, obviously having dependent children costs more than not having dependent children. And there's good stats in the ABS produces good stats on expenditure that we marry into. And you choose a time when they're going to actually. If I go back here, at some point along this curve. They're going to become married. At some point along this curve, they're also going to pick up children. and at some point on that curve they're going to drop the children. So we try and we build that in, particularly into the default, but if you know, if you're an individual, it still applies. Some more basic premises. Death cover is for members with financial dependents. Young members are inappropriately insured in most funds. Just creates family issues, and I know that because I was on the SCT. And a lot of the disputes that came up were just family law disputes on the SCT, and they were based around over-insurance and people fighting over not very large amounts of money. With death cover, we would generally suggest leaving a small amount for young people nevertheless, because it allows them to keep their death cover options going. If you go on, particularly if you opt people out of cover, it's very hard for them to get back in. So we'd leave them with a little bit, just so that they've got cover and they can say they've always had it. And for death, we choose a gender or a gender mix, so we do that twice apparently. But if the fund you're advising is predominantly female, then your member is going to be a female. If it's a mix, then you can do a half-half. And you can actually have a look at the male and the female salary structure if you want. We don't tend to do that. But in this fund, it was female-dominated, so it was a female. The female member dies, what's the economic loss, therefore, for the male spouse? I've been through that one. Now, well, this is an example of what pops up. So the blue line is the old design that this fund had, which is your typical, that's death and TPD blue line. It's your level premium design for tonight. And it's, it's your old dollar a week gone up a little bit. And that's what you get. And it was deemed that was reasonably equitable, not totally equitable, but reasonably equitable. But the death benefit equals the TPD benefit. So what you find in that situation is where you've got this massive death benefit, for what purpose? No purpose at all, really, for a 15-year-old or perhaps a 20-year-old even. But then for death, you're dramatically underinsured in the middle ages. So when we run effectively our present value calculations, we get that red line for death. That's the present value of the economic loss, taking into account the remarriage rates, etc. There's a bit of mortality in there, but it doesn't make much difference. And it's a very different design, needs-based design. The TPD benefit, in this case, this assumes you can get long-term IP. So the TPD benefit sits down there, bouncing around 100,000, and then falling off. Critically falling off, where I think as actuaries we're quite frightened about these ages for TPD, because it's a bit marginal on whether someone's still there or not. And behind that, as I said, is the long-term IP benefit, which is say 80% of the salary of those salaries that we saw, the median salaries. So this design actually covered the median member in that fund. Now what we'll find out of that design, one of the features that we'll find out of that design is we dramatically cut the premium for young members. When you look at that, we've cut their cover. And that's totally appropriate. Now the overcharging of young members is a blight for us, because their first experience quite often in a super fund is to see all their SG contribution, which is pretty small, disappear in fees and insurance premiums, and they don't need the insurance cover. So their first impression of super is very negative. Their account balance goes to zero, they get closed or they get moved off to wherever. So they get no affinity with their fund, and the whole process falls apart from day one. So when you do this sort of design and you insure them on needs-based basis, the premium rates fall dramatically for the young. Okay, now we might quickly look at the premium and then we'll get into some discussion. Okay. So when we're looking at what's the right level of premium, it's a very subjective thing, and again, that's all we can do is help a trustee make that decision. It's not our decision. There's some really good benchmarks we can look at. So we looked at where we look at four benchmarks: amount spent by members on other financial risks. So that's their house, their car, and for some people their private health cover. The original dollar per member per week. So you can roll that up, that was at 3%, so you can roll that up to 9% or 12%, add some AWATI increase, what does that come to? Some proportions of contributions coming in, or maybe a proportion of account balance. So they're the benchmarks we looked at. Very quickly, we've got, particularly the private health insurance. You spend a lot of money on private health insurance. I think this is after the rebate. I can't remember now. But nearly up to $3,500. So that's a lot more than we charge for group insurance of a risk that you might argue is a lot more significant than the private health insurance risk, at least for younger people. It does vary by age. We put a few numbers in there for... you can put whatever you want in for car insurance or house insurance. In fact, I think for both those, they probably increase with age because the sum insured goes up. But for car insurance, of course, it goes down initially with age because you get out of the accident, huh? And particularly as a male. That black line's the old dollar per member per week. Comes at about $500 now per annum. So the left-hand side here is the per annum cost. So if we're charging a dollar per member per week back in 1988, I think that started, with, I think it was CBUS. So we'd be charging now $500 for a flat, as a flat, if we thought that was fair. But I don't think that's a very good benchmark anyway. It's just interesting. But these are amounts people are willing to spend for their other financial risks. So why do we get so hung up when we spend $2 here or $3 there per week on a bit of insurance cover? Now, for that fund that I showed previously, that's 1% of contributions based on their salaries, based on the salary scale. For the two groups, that's in red. And this one shows 1% of the account balance in blue. So if they joined at age... well, I've only shown it from 21. So what can we do with all those benchmarks? Well, I mean, to me, the reason for looking at the account balance is that's the thing we're supposedly protecting. We're protecting the account balance. So it's easy for a trustee to say, how much of the account balance am I going to take away from the member every year? Is it 1%? Is it 0.5%? Is it 2%? What's a fair? But if you say to them, oh, you're going to take 1% of contributions, that isn't really protecting what you are legally and perhaps as a trustee required to consider. So we think looking at the account balance is a good way of considering the appropriateness of the premium level. The other beauty of it is that as cover increases, of course, in middle ages under a needs-based design, your premium does get quite high. But what this shows is the account balance can support that without it being inappropriately eroded. That's all that says. So in summary, I don't think it's hard to move to a needs-based design. There are very few, and most of my clients are industry funds, but there are very few of them that have actually moved to a needs-based design. To me, it's a legislative requirement. It can be implemented over time. It doesn't have to happen tomorrow. And in this market, it might be very hard to make it happen tomorrow. But it can be implemented over time. And if you have an insurer that's similarly convinced, then you can work with them to do that. And I think it can be implemented despite the current market. Thank you.
All right, we've got about 10 minutes left, so if anyone's got any questions or comments, I might just kick off with one while people are thinking of those. So my first one is, so if a fund does want to go about transforming to a needs-based design, how long does that take, given you've obviously got to agree stuff with your insurer, come up with the design, like you've got all those factors to consider, as well as obviously IT is your administrator and so on. So how's that process gone for the people that you've dealt with?
Well, the early implementers of this sort of design took about 2 years. Later implementers, we can turn it around in about 1 year.
Okay.
from when the trustee decides they want to review the design to actually telling the members that here it is. And probably an ongoing, in the current market, as I hinted before, it's an ongoing basis because it's very hard to get the long-term IP. It's a real, I guess it's a very negative feature of the current market that people aren't willing to provide what is basically an indemnity-based cover for people under IP. So you might have to go back to five-year IP and wait for the next review and then go to longer-term IP. If people are, you know, you've got to have the insurer comfortable.
Adam Fusker. Thanks, Jeff. Interested in your views around some of the discussions that you have with the trustees around making members worse off and that being a constraint around changing benefit designs. Because I agree that, you know, these needs-based designs need to happen, but, you know, obviously that seems to be a constraint that they seem to throw up. So interested in your views on that.
Well, we never reduce their sum insured. So the initial cohort will get the better of, basically, or what they've got now or what they would have under the new design. And then all the new members come in on this design. And what that does is, the other thing we do with this design, we break it up into units so that people can dial down if they don't like the amount of premium that is involved or the amount of cover. They don't need that amount of cover or that premium. They can dial it down. They can obviously opt out if they want. Nowadays, we'd only give them options to dial up with some sort of health evidence. It might be fairly minor, but there's still some sort of health evidence.
Okay, so you've touched on it. In terms of the, you know, how do you get competitive tension and tender in the current market? So that you've touched on the fact that, you know, maybe you can't get long-term IP.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a lottery, really, getting competitive tension. I think I hinted before that the if you can persuade the insurers that this is the risk you're trying to insure, this is what we're trying to do with the design, it's a lot easier with a small fund than a large fund because the small funds don't need the reinsurance support, and there is no reinsurance support, so a lot of the competitive tension just has disappeared because you cannot get reinsurance support for any design. So for a lot of funds, all they can do is talk to their incumbent, and that's it. There's no magic, and it's a bit of a lottery. Yeah, we did a tender where we got 6 expressions of interest back. By the time we'd issued the tender, there were only 3 interested. So even though they said, you know, we want to see the tender, gone. Yeah, it's just too hard. And there's a massive productivity problem for the industry, and we don't have enough actuaries to do all the work that's now required, supposedly, to produce a tender. So insurers have to rationalise their resource, and that's a very expensive resource. It's very expensive to do a tender. You've got to pick and choose which ones you're going to do. Trustees understand that. So there's real competition for that resource, I guess, as there is for the capital of the insurers. Very hard. Very hard.
Thanks. Andrew Linford from Munich Re. I think with all the commentary about reinsurers' response, I felt I need to get up and maybe make a remark or two. I really like what you're putting forward in terms of defining a benefit that fits the need much, much better. It's all about the insurable interest of the members. I totally agree that young kids don't need, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of cover. Absolutely. A lot of what's wrong at the moment, I think, comes from poor design. And we're giving lottery tickets, really. And that just makes fraud a lot more likely. And, you know, a lot of these claims are really hard to tell if they're valid or not. I love my job when I get to pay a claim that I know is valid, and I hate it when I have to pay a claim that's not, or hate it even more when I have to when I feel I have to decline a claim that might be valid. That's just the worst, and it doesn't give any of us a good reputation. So I think that process will be really helpful. I'm disappointed that it's only applying to new members. I think it'll take a long, long time for that to race through and fix all the problems with the big industry funds. but I'm not sure if it's practical to do it any faster. One question I'll get to. I was surprised about your chart that showed, I think, a third of the industry funds that you've commented on before since 1 July 2012 didn't have a rate increase. I've only been in this job less than 12 months, but everyone I've seen has had a rate increase and a material rate increase. Maybe I just don't see the others. Can you identify any common features of the ones that didn't get a rate increase so maybe we have a better understanding of why that is? I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll leave it there.
Okay. That's a good question. And other people might have some views too on that. I think there are a group of particularly large industry funds that had a bit of a dream run when they went to market in 2009 and 2010. And were able to go back to the insurers again and again and again and get price reductions. That maybe in hindsight you wouldn't have taken, but as a trustee, if the insurers are competitively bidding, it's very hard not to, I imagine, accept their good judgment that you're in a very, very good position to provide those sustainable rates. They had no reason to believe that. I know in one case I had been asked to set what I thought was a fair premium, and the insurers initially were above that, and then they came sort of down to it, and then they just kept going down, down, down. But then we had the secondary problem that then if the ceding office then takes that to the reinsurance market and then runs a competitive reinsurance tender, which is what happened in that period, the reinsurers then overlay a very competitive tender on a very competitive tender. Now, I think there was a lot of perhaps over-optimism on where things were going to happen. The experience would eventuate. And you can identify those funds relatively easy. There's three of them. There's other funds where the experience is the TPD. Their predominant benefit for disability is TPD. And that experience has gone bad. They will have, and I know one fund that has a sister fund, so they pretty well cover the same industry. One provides an income stream as its primary benefit, and one provides the lump sum. The income stream fund has not had a premium increase, and the other one, large premium increase. So I think there are some really interesting reasons, and then there's some funds where it's just not really explainable other than the fact that TPD is the primary benefit. So I know I do a lot of work with the REST fund, and that was the first fund that went to needs-based with a long-term IP. And the experience in REST for IP, long-term IP, has been very, very good. It's supported the fund. It's been fairly predictable. Amazingly, it was the hardest one to predict, and we got that one right. We got death wrong. Yeah, you can't always... Yeah, we're only actuaries. If it was that easy to predict the premium, you wouldn't need actuaries. None of us would have a job. So it is very hard to predict these things, and we don't get it right. We have a control cycle mentality, which is very good. And that's what we're going through at the moment. It's the control cycle. But there's no need to panic out of it. It's just we're going through the control cycle. Now, the reinsurers, to me, when they make big losses because they've been through a competitive tender, I mean, to me, I think as an insurer, you've then got to suck that up. Because if you then go and say, now I'm going to go and claw all that loss back, that's when you damage your reputation because you're not really seen then as an insurer. And I think that's how the trustees see it. That's where the reputation risk is that I was referring to before.
Probably got time for one more question if anyone's got any there. Okay.
Rod Berry, thanks, Jeff. I guess a comment and leading into a question. So one of the central tenets of the problems we've been seeing comes down to moral hazard, understanding, I think as Andrew Linford said, what's a true claim, what's not, and predicting how that will go into the future. A needs-based design would, in theory, as you said, by just replacing the economic loss, would not give an incentive for moral hazard because, in theory, the member would not be any better off after claiming than they were before claiming. So my question is, do trustees, or are trustees starting to consider that moral hazard, and are they perhaps thinking about how they can, help the insurer to come up with the right price that deals with that moral hazard so that it's only genuine members who are claiming and not paying these lottery tickets to members who actually don't have a valid entitlement to claim?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think trustees are a lot more aware of the issues now. I don't deal with any trustees that don't recognise that the claims experience today is the premium of tomorrow. So to some extent, the trustees, particularly the large super funds, they're self-insured for the future, because anything they do today will affect their future premium, and they can't get out of that. They're in that. They're caught in that. The insurer has a very short-term period of existence legally, even shorter nowadays with the short guarantees. And so I think trustees are very aware that they need designs that are actually going to be robust and actually direct the premium to the people who need it. They're very keen on that.
Cool. Thanks, Jeff. It's really good to have a discussion that's from the side of the actual members and the trustees. We've had a lot about what's happening with the insurers, but this is really good to actually talk from the side. Can you just all join me in thanking Jeff? And I've got a bottle of wine for you to say...